Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence, who I'm very pleased to say brings it to bear with some regularity here at Secure Freedom Radio, is our first guest. He is Robert Charles, a former Assistant Secretary of State, responsible for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement in the George W. Bush administration. He has served other presidents, including George W.'s father, George H.W., and Ronald Reagan. He is the author, most recently, of a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens, and a frequent guest at Fox News, and I'm happy to say, as I indicated, here as well. Robert, welcome back. Good to have you, as always.
Thank you very much, Frank.
I'm always appreciative of your expertise in and insights about the border, and I wondered, in the context of the thrash that is still going on over whether or not to secure it, to do a fact check, if I can, with you, Robert, and that is that we are insistently told that having a wall won't make any difference in narcotics trafficking, which is huge and growing, by all accounts, causing the death of tens of thousands of Americans every year, because those drugs flow through the ports of entry, not across the porous border that is unfenced. Would you walk us through the facts here, please?
Sure. Well, I think that's not true. Every deterrent, there are two basic reasons for that wall, or for any deterrent at our borders, which is both, which I include both maritime and land borders. And the two reasons are that you actually physically stop this transshipment. And we have most of the drugs that are killing Americans today come from foreign sources. We do have domestically grown marijuana. We do have domestic synthetics. But in reality, the cocaine, the heroin, the fentanyl, all of the other synthetics, a lot of the meth, the vast majority of the recorded CDC deaths every year come from foreign source or foreign origin drugs, which means that it's very important to be engaged in these countries: Colombia, Bolivia, Peru, China, Thailand, you name the production source. And it's also critical that you interdict, or that you intercept, and we say interdict, but that at both the land, both between ports of entry and at ports of entry. We know, as an absolute empirical fact over the last 30 years, that when you have greater assets on target, and Paul Yost was probably the greatest example of this back in the late 80s. He pulsed resources to particular locations around the United States, on the exterior of the United States. And wherever you pulsed, you picked up more and you deterred more. So that the reality is, whenever you have a deterrent like a true barrier, or an intercept, you absolutely will pick up more of the drugs, and that keeps them from our streets. The second thing you do is you deter, and deterrence in many ways is the critical. It is the deterrence is the linchpin or the Achilles heel of law enforcement. There, if we did not have deterrence today, most crime, if you had sort of no expectation that the rule of law would be enforced, crimes would multiply by the 10 and 20 fold. Because there is deterrence, we have
a semblance of the rule of law.
Yeah, it's simple. But the truth is, Frank, we've walked away over the last 10 years from any sense of real deterrence at the border and internationally on the drug issue. And it's really a shame. We're seeing that in drug deaths.
And you know, Robert, one other factor that I think is implicit in what you said, but just to make it explicit, if you indeed can not only deter but impede access to our border for those trying to bring illegal substances, drugs, narcotics, murderous content, by closing the spaces between those ports of entry through whatever means is appropriate, you're enabling the law enforcement community to put more resources to bear at making sure that bad stuff isn't coming through those ports of entry either, right?
Absolutely. You're creating a choke point, which is exactly what you want to do. You force effort against the place of greatest threat or greatest risk. And you know, the bigger picture here, if you step back 20 paces, is the United States can either encourage, we can either permit a vicious cycle to continue, or we can encourage a virtuous cycle. And what is the encouragement of the virtuous cycle? When you deter drugs from coming into the United States and deter drug use inside the United States, and you ultimately, you know, put criminal elements, leave criminal elements on the outside, it forces a lot of these countries, and I use Colombia as an example, to clean up their own act and to ultimately reinforce the rule of law at home. And what we have learned is that in places ranging from, you know, Costa Rica, Peru, Colombia, Thailand, when you actually reinforce to them that rule of law is important, because you enforce your own laws and you help them to enforce their laws, the upshot of all that is that you end up with a safer and a healthier world.
Let me turn very quickly, Robert, to another topic that has been much in the news of late, particularly following a expose, I guess they would call it, at the New York Times, that the FBI was so concerned about Donald Trump's relationships with the Russians that they actually opened a counterintelligence operation against him to ferret out whether he was indeed a Russian agent in the Oval Office. What did you make of this story?
You know, Frank, in a nutshell, it boggles the mind. I think you can only say that it's an indicia, or it's an indicator of how truly, in my view, off the deep end those inside the FBI were before this campaign and after the campaign, when you had people like McCabe and Strzok and Comey and others literally saying to themselves, like guys standing in a circle, patting each other on the back with their crazy theory that he was under the pay of the Russians. You know, it's so mind-boggling, because it's essentially this business about drinking the Kool-Aid that you've created that is utterly untrue. And I find, you know, the thing I think about, and every average American should, I think, is imagine if you were in the position of Donald Trump. You love your country. You've given up. Frankly, you could have endless wealth forever without any risk, but you've given it up to lead your country. You everybody from friends and supporters around the United States that elect you to your family are integrated into a deep and absolutely sort of shining commitment to your country. And what happens is you're told that the FBI is after you, because this was a group of people that in their own texts makes crystal clear that they were all in the Hillary camp. They disdained him from the outset.
And sought to defeat him. It wasn't just that they disdained him. They wanted to defeat him. And if he did somehow become president, to prevent him from being a successful one. Robert, we have to leave it at that for the moment, sadly. There's much more on this to talk about, and we'll look forward to doing so with you in the near future. But thank you for your time today, as well as your continuing service to our country. Keep it up, my friend. We'll speak up next with Fred Flights about what is going on with Iran, and is there an attack in the offing? Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Fred Flights, the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy, a career intelligence professional with very extensive experience in the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of State, and the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee, as well as most recently being the Chief of Staff and Executive Secretary of the National Security Council under President Trump and Ambassador John Bolton. Fred, you have been very much on top of a number of the issues that I wanted to catch up with you about quickly. And I think I'd start by saying, first of all, of course, welcome back. It's always good to have you. But I'd like to pick up on a conversation that I was just having with our friend Robert Charles about this, scandal, we're told, that the FBI was investigating Donald Trump out of concern that he was a Russian agent working in, of all places, the Oval Office. What did you make of this story in the New York Times, among other places now?
It's good to be here, Frank. Frank, it was so ridiculous. It didn't cite any evidence that the FBI had for this. After the president made a lawful decision to fire Comey, basically what happened is that his colleagues at the FBI retaliated. They retaliated with his investigation because they were irritated that Comey, who was leading their revolt against the president, was let go. And I mean, that's all that I see that's here. And I'm still waiting for someone to show me the collusion, someone to show me the reason that we've spent such huge amounts of money for investigations on a made up scandal that was simply designed to undermine the Trump candidacy, the Trump transition, and the Trump presidency.
Well, you know, there's another piece of it that I think is of very much akin to what you've just said, but it takes it another step. And that is that these individuals, with Comey's departure, were presumably quite fearful, having already lost the cover that Hillary Clinton would have provided them had she become president, that Comey afforded them for the kind of misconduct that they were engaged in going after Trump as a candidate, and then, as you say, during the transition and subsequently during his presidency. So the most remarkable thing to me about the FBI story in the New York Times was that the nature of the characters who were almost certainly driving this train and their agendas, their vested interest in covering their butts, didn't seem to get much ink at all.
No, I think that's right. And I also think we have to hearken back to four words written on the Supreme Court building: equal justice under law. There was a different standard for prosecuting President Trump and people in a circle and very weak evidence. And it differed vastly from the very serious charges of treason and collusion with the Russians against Hillary Clinton and people in her circle. I mean, she destroyed evidence, as you know. There's the email server in her home, violations of security regulations. The same group of people investigated both cases, and they used a different standard. And frankly, that's why this whole situation undermines the confidence of Americans in our justice system. The same standards have to apply to everyone, and clearly they weren't.
Yeah, indeed. This brings me to another question, which I think as a result of your time in the National Security Council, you have a particular ability to speak to, Fred Flights, and that is charges that Donald Trump's collusion with the Russians is somehow evident in the fact that he has withheld or otherwise concealed the transcripts of his conversations with Vladimir Putin. What light can you shed on all of that?
It's a very disturbing story. It's more fake news. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia said on CNN over the weekend that the U.S. government does not know what Trump and Putin discussed in two one-on-one meetings. Frank, that's absolutely false. There were two of these meetings, one in Germany in 2017, one in Helsinki, Finland, in mid-2018. The first meeting, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, was there, took notes, and briefed senior officials on what happened. I know from the Executive Secretary of the National Security Council that all the senior officials that Trump wanted included, I don't know how many there were, but there were a bunch of them, and I was one of them. We knew exactly what was discussed in the Helsinki meeting. And you know, Senator Warner or others are trying to claim that the president hid details and what was discussed in these meetings because he was saying something nefarious or was related to collusion. It's completely untrue. What happened here is that the president restricted access to what was discussed in these meetings to prevent leaks. And I think some of the potential leakers, career officers, they're angry that they didn't get access to this information so they could leak it. But it isn't true that senior officials do not know exactly what was discussed in both meetings.
Well, so we're being told this for the purposes, presumably, of continuing to promote this, it would appear, false narrative that the president has engaged or others on his behalf have engaged in some sort of conspiracy with Russia collusion, if you will, that has put at risk the national security of the United States. And again, Fred, you worked for the man. You had access to much of this traffic at the time, and I know have been studiously following these reports. Is there any sort of conclusion to be drawn other than that the president is continuing to be subjected to a campaign to discredit and ultimately remove him from office by not just people inside of the United States government, but obviously the people that they frequently, if not chronically, leak to?
I think that's right. And you know, what's odd about the story is that there's nothing new here. And these meetings took place, like one was in July 2018, the other was in the spring of 2017. The fact the president met with Putin one-on-one with restricted staff, this isn't a secret. This has been on the record. Someone decided to gin this up now because that's what the press wants. They want to run a negative story against the president every day. And one day, Greg Miller of the Washington Post decided to conjure up the story. I might add, I talked to NSC staff. They worked hard with Miller to try to get the story right. He wasn't interested in getting it right. He just wanted to write a hit piece, and that's where this came from.
Yeah, well, and it's not alone, that's for sure. But Fred, I'd have to say, one other thing that's new, unfortunately, is that there is an opportunity in the House of Representatives, at least, to gin up a whole new investigative effort to chase down these so-called revelations and exposés. And it seems as though this is part of a concerted effort to not only keep Trump on his back foot, but also to promote a narrative that is otherwise without justification. And it must be enormously frustrating to the president and his team. And having been one of them, I know it is for you as well. Hey, listen, let me switch gears, Fred, in the remaining time we have with you. There have been leaks as well to the effect that John Bolton has somehow exceeded his authority or otherwise engaged in some sort of, well, problematic behavior, shall we say, by asking the Pentagon to develop plans for attacking Iran in the wake of some attacks by Iranian proxies on American facilities in Iraq. Tell us what's going on in that domain.
Well, there was a Wall Street Journal article by an author named Dion Nissenbaum who can't stand Ambassador Bolton. And I'll say that on the record. He's written stuff, repeated fake news stories.
Not too high on you either, as I recall.
No, he's written fake news stories. I mean, one of which I might add, we killed by talking to the Wall Street Journal editor. But I don't want to get into that. He wrote a story saying that Bolton made the unprecedented decision of asking the Pentagon for options to attack Iran after Iranian-backed militants fired on the U.S. embassy and the U.S. consulate in Iraq in last September. Well, Senator Joe Lieberman said on Fox News last week, and that was entirely appropriate for Mr. Bolton to give the president those options, not that he endorsed them, because Iran attacked our diplomatic facilities. Now, Nissenbaum tried to play this down by saying, well, look, nobody was hurt. No, there was very little property damage. Frank, Iran attacked a U.S. diplomatic facility, two of them, and we have to look at all the options. This is what national security advisors do. This is just more fake news by a reporter who's notorious for writing fake news.
What's particularly fake, though, Fred, as anybody who has had any experience with national security, as you and I both have had, is the idea that somehow this is unprecedented. I mean, please, as you say, this is what national security advisors do. This is what the Pentagon does, for heaven's sakes. There are contingency plans for everything you can think of in the Pentagon's vaults. And not to have them at hand, or at least dusted off, or better yet, updated in the circumstance in which there's an actual physical attack on Americans and American facilities is, it would be irresponsible in the extreme were John Bolton not to have sought such options, I would think.
That's exactly right. And there's a related story that was in the Wall Street Journal piece and the Washington Post piece that you mentioned. Somehow that Bolton is going rogue and he's doing things the president doesn't support. That is just absolutely untrue. John Bolton gives his candid advice to the president and does exactly what the president has approved. He's always been that way. And his detractors, unfortunately, some on the right and the left, they're trying to pretend otherwise. But I got to tell you, this is a very important principle for Mr. Bolton. His view is the guy who won the election makes the foreign policy. He's always been true to that, in my experience.
Well, and your experience is extensive, not only on the NSC in the current administration, but of course you worked for him for years in the George W. Bush administration when he was the Undersecretary of State. And I just have to say, that's been my experience of the man, and I think it's a cardinal principle for the sensible reason that when you start assuming unto yourself heirs and responsibilities that aren't yours and shouldn't be, you are going to run afoul of the president. And I think, frankly, the constitutional responsibilities, your oath of office established. Fred, we have to leave it at that, my friend. I appreciate so much your time and your service to our country. I know we'll talk next week. Meantime, keep up the good work, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Gordon Chang, our duty expert on matters involving Asia. He is similarly regarded highly by a number of other outlets and, well, the policy establishment writ large. He is a columnist for the Daily Beast. He is also a frequent contributor to The National Interest and Fox News, the author of two important books, one, The Coming Collapse of China, and the other, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. He's also been spending some time talking about, thinking about something that has come to my attention only recently and is very, very troubling. And that is an effort, it seems, to, well, undo what President Trump, I think, quite rightly did last year to try to preserve a very important national treasure, as his administration has called it, namely a company that's involved in state-of-the-art chip design and manufacturing, Qualcomm. Gordon Chang, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have a chance to talk with you, especially about this particular topic.
Well, thank you so much, Frank, because this really is critical to the future of the United States.
And yet it seems to have gotten essentially zero attention, and that's why I'm anxious to sort of talk through this with you, Gordon. So the president last year, just to recap, intervened to prevent Qualcomm from being taken over by a Singapore-based company called Broadcom. Remind us what that was about and why he acted as he did.
Broadcom is a major player. It has unlocked shareholder value by buying companies, breaking them up, and selling them off for parts. Now, that is very good for shareholders, but it's very bad for Qualcomm. Qualcomm is a patent machine. It is America's only real contestant in the race for 5G, the next generation of wireless devices. And clearly, if Broadcom had been able to take over Qualcomm, and it was on the verge of doing so last year,
in a hostile takeover, as I recall, right?
Hostile takeover. And if Qualcomm was broken up into parts, essentially Huawei Technologies, the Chinese telecom equipment manufacturer, would dominate 5G not only in China, but around the world. So President Trump acted to protect Qualcomm. And it's important that we do so now because the FTC is actually trying to do the same thing through a back door.
Yeah. Now, the FTC, of course, is the Federal Trade Commission. It's an independent commission, an agency of the United States government. But it is very much working at cross purposes, it would seem, with what President Trump was trying to do to preserve, as I say, this national treasure. How is it doing that, Gordon?
Yeah, the FTC brought a case 3 days before President Trump was inaugurated. And the idea was that it was attacking Qualcomm's revenue streams, its licensing income. This is the money that allows Qualcomm to do the research that gives it the lead in not only 3G, not only 4G, but hopefully in 5G as well. And the FTC, and this gets a bit complicated in terms of U.S. anti-monopoly law, but was essentially raising new theories. Now, whatever one thinks of the evolving competition law, one does not need to reach to break up Qualcomm in this particular case, Because as we just mentioned in connection with the Broadcom acquisition, you know, if Qualcomm is in any way prevented from doing the research and all of the spending necessary to set standards for 5G, the United States is lost. Remember, 5G is going to connect almost everything. And that means that if the Chinese were able to control 5G, they could turn off your pacemaker in New York. They could take a school bus or whatever and ram it into a play yard. They could take a drone and basically crash it into a rock concert. All of these things they could do in the U.S. if they controlled 5G. And that's why it's so important that we protect Qualcomm. People may say the United States should not have gotten into a situation where Qualcomm is so critical, one company so critical to the future of the U.S. That's an important issue, but that's not a problem that we need to fix now. The problem we need to fix now is that the Chinese are making a big play for 5G.
Gordon, the thing that adds just, you know, unbelievable outrage to this whole proposition is, as I understand it, the case that is now before a federal judge by the name of Lucy Ko in San Francisco, this pursuit by the Federal Trade Commission, as you say, the Obama team, and many of whom are now apparently holdovers on the staff of the Federal Trade Commission, are the people who have brought this case. But they apparently have a judge who is very sympathetic to the idea that Qualcomm must be essentially, it seems, destroyed, because the issue in the case, as I understand it, is their licensing arrangements for their intellectual property, both what they charge and their unwillingness to let companies that are known competitors license their technology in the, I think, reasonably certain confidence that they will steal that technology, especially if it's Huawei. And yet, in this trial, apparently, Huawei, Qualcomm's chief competitor, is going to be the star witness for breaking up Qualcomm. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Am I missing something, Gordon, or is that basically a fair characterization of what's afoot here?
The only thing that you missed, Frank, was that this case is in San Jose, but it is the Northern District of California, which does include San Francisco. Everything else you said, absolutely 100% right. On the first day of the trial, both Huawei and Lenovo, which is another Chinese company, were the FTC's star witnesses, which means that you have Huawei and the FTC working together to kill off Qualcomm. This is just so wrong from a national security perspective.
It's national security and economic security as well. It's the whole kit and caboodle. And, you know, sort of the examples that you mentioned, Gordon, may sound, you know, pretty mild. But when you think about it, it's access to everything that would flow through the 5G pipelines, all of the information, the data, the proprietary, you know, intellectual property, government information, and the like. And again, as you've so clearly pointed out in some of our previous conversations about this, it's not just in America that this would happen. These guys are angling to try to essentially control the pipes, the digital infrastructure, as it's called, for the world. So all of our allies, developing nations, and so on. I mean, this would give the Chinese, as you say, a national security competitive advantage, as well as one that may be decisive in terms of future economic prosperity and growth as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, China would know everything in the world. Well, virtually everything. When you think and you think about artificial intelligence, the Chinese, in all probability, will have more capable AI than we will. And the reason is AI is really built on data. And in China, they will have a lot of data. There are no restrictions on Chinese data collection. In our society, we're a democracy. We have restrictions, and thank God for them. But one of the disadvantages of this is that their AI will be better than ours, just because they'll have so much more information. Well, if Huawei controls 5G worldwide, then they're going to have incredible amounts of data. They'll have all of our data and all of their data. So, you know, this is one of those other aspects to it that, you know, we've got to think through. So Qualcomm, whether we like it or not, is the national treasure. It's a company that we need to protect. And we need to make sure that an American company dominates 5G. Because as you point out, if you don't have 5G, you're going to lose out in so many other aspects as well.
Amen. Gordon, let me switch gears in a similar vein, but slightly different focus. There is a fellow by the name of Robert Zoellick, who has been a swamp creature for a long time in Washington, and rising through various government positions to be the president of the World Bank before he retired from that slot. He has held forth recently warning Donald Trump that you cannot contain the People's Republic of China, and more to the point, shouldn't even be trying. Talk us through what Zoellick's argument is and what you make of it.
Yeah, Zoellick has said exactly what you mentioned, and then he talks about cooperation. If you can't contain China, Frank, you either have to cooperate with it or defeat it. And so what Zoellick is doing is leaving us with those two choices, because in his argument for continuing to work with China, to cooperate with it, he raises nothing new. In other words, he's talking about solutions that have failed and failed miserably over the last four decades. And as we've seen, as China's grown stronger, it's become more belligerent, more bellicose, more hostile, and certainly less amenable to being bound by global rules.
Well, but to that point, Gordon, just talk through with us what cooperation looks like when you're dealing with a China that has those characteristics.
If you're trying to cooperate with China, we have seen that that approach doesn't work. It means giving the Chinese everything that they want and also not getting anything that we want. And so that's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but that's really the way things have gone, especially over the last 5 years or so, because China has made it very clear that it will not be bound by rules, norms, treaties, conventions, even those things that it's agreed to. So what Zoellick is saying is basically that we just give up.
Well, submit, I would argue, is the point. You know, it's cooperating on China's terms, which essentially means, as we were talking about in the context of, 5G, allowing them to dictate what we will do, what we won't do, who will we be, and, you know, what freedoms we'll enjoy, the whole nine yards at some point, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what Zoellick is doing is I think he's actually is exaggerating, because I do believe that we can contain China. We can contain it by disengaging from it. But, you know, if Zoellick is right, and if he does win the argument that you can't contain China, then essentially we're left with only one choice, and that is to defeat it.
Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment. But thank you for this clarion call, specifically on the importance of Donald Trump doing as he did last year, putting America first with respect to this issue of Qualcomm. We'll be discussing further with Kevin Freeman in a moment how that might be done. Thank you, Gordon. We'll talk with you next week. Stay tuned for more with Kevin Freeman, our duty expert on economic warfare and how the Chinese are waging it against us, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We have in the House virtually our duty expert on economic warfare, and who better to continue the conversation we just had with Gordon Chang about 5G technology and the distinct possibility that America's ability to compete globally in this all-important technology space is hanging by a thread, of all places, in a courtroom in San Jose, California. Kevin Freeman is our senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. His battle space is economic warfare. That is the subject of his blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, as well as Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, the title of his terrific television program, which you can see at Blaze TV. It's so good to have you back, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Thanks, Frank. I'm doing great.
Wonderful. Well, Gordon and I were just talking about this story with Qualcomm, and you have been tracking other aspects of what the Chinese are up to vis-a-vis this company and vis-a-vis Apple and other American technology firms. The story that there could well be an adverse ruling by this federal judge, which could be very detrimental to not only Qualcomm as a company, but to America in terms of its competitive position in the 5G sort of sector is very alarming to me, but so are some of the other things that are going on with the Chinese and our tech firms. Talk us through all this, if you would.
Well, you know, we always say what we see as a marketplace or enemies view as a battle space. So what appears in California courts to be a normal legal tussle over intellectual property is actually a pawn in the larger scale of economic warfare that the Chinese are perpetrating. And they're not against using our legal system to achieve their purposes, and they're also willing to use their legal system to achieve their purposes. In every case, you know, China wins because this is real warfare. This isn't just two American companies deciding where the intellectual property belongs. This is an opportunity for the Chinese to force crack open intellectual property from American companies and make it available for their use, either by hacking or legal means.
And we're seeing increasing alarms being sounded by the U.S. government over the theft of intellectual property. And I gather those alarms are now increasingly being heard from tech companies themselves in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. And Kevin, when you aggregate all of this, it just would seem as though we need to throw a flag on this play. This is unrestricted warfare playing out in real time with very real stakes. And you've been studying up on the 5G phenomenon. Could you just give us a quick course on what are the stakes if we wind up losing the competition with China on 5G?
Well, yeah. First, you mentioned that the tech companies themselves, there's an interesting story yesterday on CNBC. The headline, tech execs are telling Jim Cramer, behind closed doors that they support Trump's hardline trade policy on China. And of course, they can't do that publicly because then they get blasted and boycotted and everything else by the radical left. But the reality is China's been stealing. And if they get control of the next generation of technology, they will export it under their control to the rest of the world, isolating America and putting us in a position where we are left out economically, and they will dominate. This is a part of their unrestricted warfare plan.
Yeah, but let's tease that out. It's technology, not just information flows, but it's the combination of the two that are particularly worrying. This whole idea of an Internet of Things, which would essentially control all aspects of our lives. You know, I keep hearkening back, being of a certain age, Kevin, to 2001, A Space Odyssey, and Hal telling Dave, the supercomputer that's controlling the space station on which the astronaut is trying to flee, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that. I can't let you out." When the supercomputers of the future that are, you know, controlling everything in our households and other aspects of our lives, literally depending upon the digital infrastructure that the Chinese might own and operate, what could be the implications of harm being done to us in the economic battle space or otherwise, Kevin Freeman?
Well, there's two implications. One of them is obviously the Chinese could put backdoors into all the equipment so that they can control, monitor, and they're doing that in China. And you know, there was pushback from the Huawei foundries. Oh, we don't allow that. We wouldn't do that. And I think, what a joke. And then he goes on to say, and President Trump is a great president, just to show how disingenuous he is. But the other one is, he who programs the artificial intelligence controls the world, because if you program the artificial intelligence with a bias, then it follows that bias forever. And human beings are flawed, and Chinese are worse because they're actually intentionally creating a bias to achieve the China dream, or the China at the top of the world. You know, Made in China 2025 is all about the Chinese way dominating the planet. And so when they program the artificial intelligence and you press on the Ring doorbell, it doesn't just look at your picture. Just imagine if it then gives the state apparatus control over who's at your front door and what deliveries are being made. And pretty soon they can control all aspects of your life, and we end up in a George Orwell novel.
Yeah, it's actually beyond Orwell, I think. It's Orwell on steroids. And Kevin Freeman, this sounds like science fiction, and yet one of the things that has really caught me by surprise, and I suspect many in our audience, is the pace with which this 5G revolution is advancing. This is not something that we'll have a decade or more to sort of get our head around or adopt sensible policies to govern. By some estimates, and I think you've had on your program Declan Ganley, who we featured on ours a month or so ago, and he is making the point that at the end of February, this Mobile World Congress is going to possibly be the venue in which the Chinese say, checkmate, we've got this locked down. Now, there's arguments about whether they can or not, but is that what you're hearing as well? And is that credible in terms of the extent to which this is upon us?
Well, it is what I'm hearing. It's credible, but it won't show up in March. You won't notice in March that your life changes dramatically, but the seeds will be sown, the deed will be done, and the pieces will be put in place. And so, you know, what we put in our home now, Alexa, order me a pizza, will be Alexa spying on you, monitoring, controlling your behavior, monitoring everything that you're doing. If China has control, they've proven it in their own nation, they're going to use that control with social credit scores and monitor and control people, then if they have control of the rest of the technology of the rest of the world, they'll simply export it. And our tech companies have unfortunately gone along with them in China, and they could do it here. So in February, the decision could be made for the 5G standard, and if it is Chinese 5G standard under Huawei and so forth, then at some point in our future, that bad news will be brought to us, but we will have been like the frog sitting in the kettle. It'll get hotter and hotter, and we'll get boiled. Yeah.
Kevin, you mentioned one of those technology companies, Apple, and some of what the Chinese courts have been doing to them. They're also what Chinese consumers have been doing to them, and it is having a rather pronounced effect on both their bottom line and share value and perhaps even their future prospects. What's going on there? Is this just the ebb and flow of, you know, consumer preferences with more Chinese competition now being found to be more appealing to more Chinese, or is there something larger at work as you see it?
Well, there's a combination of things. First, Apple made an announcement, pre-announcement, that their earnings wouldn't be what they expected. They lowered their revenue expectations, and they blamed China. It's mostly because of what's happening in China. Well, there are two things that happen in China. One is if you hack and continue to steal intellectual property, you can build some pretty good stuff. And the Chinese are good engineers, and they've stolen a lot of property, and they built quality phones that are competitive with Apple in the Chinese marketplace. The second thing is you've got the Chinese government in a trade war with the United States. Do you want to, as an executive, be sporting an Apple phone, or do you want to be sporting a made-in-China phone? And the third thing is the Chinese economy is really hurting. And so the idea of going out and buying an expensive phone, particularly an American, is far less appealing. They don't need to do it for the better technology because the technology is caught up in a lot of ways. They don't want to do it for politically correct reasons, and they can't afford to do it even if they wanted to do it.
Kevin Freeman, we'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.